You're listening to the Dr. Nina Show with Dr. Nina Savelle Rocklin, only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Dr. Nina Show here on LA Talk Radio. I'm your host, Dr. Nina Savelle Rocklin, and I am here to help you make peace with food. Stop counting calories, carbs, and fat grams so you can easily get to a healthy weight without dieting and get on with your life. I want you to wake up and think about your day, not your diet. If you would like to join me today, the number is 323-203-0815. That's 323-203-0815. I would love to hear what is on your mind, what is weighing on you, because the real problem with binge eating, stress eating, any kind of emotional eating, the real problem is not food. It is what is eating at you that is the problem. And that's what I'm here to help you out with. So today, oh, and by the way, hi, Josh. Hi, Maya on Instagram. You can also find me on Instagram. Today, I would like to talk about why most New Year's resolutions fail. Today is December 29th. It is our last show of 2021. Can you believe that? I cannot believe it is almost 2022. That is just crazy. How is it almost 2022? Okay, so did you ever wonder why most New Year's resolutions fail? There is one simple reason. Goals for new year, new me are all about behavior, or they're usually all about behavior. They're about things that we see as wrong about ourselves. So maybe your New Year's resolutions are to lose weight, stop eating carbs, go to the gym more often, stuff like that. These are great goals to have, but I'm sure you know that willpowering your way through these goals will actually prevent you from achieving them or from sticking to them in the long run. It is tough to keep relying on willpower when we have years, sometimes decades, of old stories and negative feelings about those very things. In fact, staying in the I can't feel good about myself until I'm skinny kind of mentality, that is exactly what keeps us in a yo-yo dieting cycle. And that is a cycle of dieting and deprivation, followed by binging, usually. When we give up dieting, we also give up the belief that we deserve to be treated well only after we lose weight. If you have a story that goes along the lines of, hey, when I lose weight, then I will do this, have that, let myself enjoy life in these ways, then you're putting your life on hold until you're at a certain weight, which is kind of tragic. It keeps us in that yo-yo cycle of dieting. I've got to lose weight so I can deserve these good things. But that is always followed by binging. So in this today, I would like to talk about the reasons that those kinds of resolutions fail. I'm going to talk about New Year's resolutions that you can set that you will want to stick to and why. And I'm going to give you some ways to keep them in front of you throughout the year so you remember them. So here are my New Year's resolution rules. Rule number one, instead of focusing on changing your behavior, focus on being your very own best friend. Why? Why would you do that? Because most of the resolutions that focus on negative feelings about yourself just make you feel bad about yourself. A lot of times we tell ourselves things like, I have to work out because I'm fat, or I need to lose weight so I'll be happy. And when we realize we don't need to lose weight to live the lives we want to be living, we stop obsessing over calories, we start feeling better, we wake up and we think about our day, not our diet. And that is actually when the weight comes off more easily. Many people say, well, I will be happy when I lose weight. And my answer to that is often, well, actually, when you're happy is probably when you're going to lose weight. Losing weight does make us happy for a brief period of time. People, every time I say something like that, someone writes me and says, I lost weight and I was happy. of course you were happy. But, you know, for how long? Because you lose weight, you feel good, but how long do you sustain that? How long do you feel good just because you're at a certain weight? Ultimately, you got to find a way to be with yourself in a different way so that you can sustain that happiness regardless of whatever the number is on the scale. So what are some ways to do that? Be nice to yourself. Be kind to yourself. When you're nice to yourself, you're more likely to be motivated to do and achieve the things you want because they bring you happiness, not because you should do them or you have to do them or you're supposed to do them. So be the friend to yourself that you want others to be to you. Do nice things for yourself. Take steps to make yourself feel loved and cared for. Maybe even bring yourself flowers. I have a friend who does that. And she's like, every time she goes and gets flowers for herself, it just makes her happy. It just brightens her day. It just feels good. So why wait for someone else to send you flowers? Give yourself some flowers. You are worthy of those things exactly as you are today, in exactly the weight you are, the job you are, the relationship status you are, the place in life you are. You deserve to feel good. In fact, one of the things you can think about is, if you wouldn't say it to a friend, a child, or someone you love, don't say it to yourself. And if you are upset, what would you say to a friend, a child, or someone you love? Speak to yourself as you would speak to a friend. So I challenge you to try five new Year's resolutions. And there's a good chance you may actually achieve what you want and maintain it for a long time when you do this. Not only that, your heart and mind will be in a much better place very soon. How would that make you feel? So number one, recommit. Recommit. Take a moment to recommit to you. Recommit to yourself. Visualize a revitalized, glowing, thriving, happy you. Create an intention to recommit to your well-being. That can sound like, I am recommitting to myself, to my health, to my happiness, and to self-acceptance and love. Number two, reevaluate. Ask yourself, what is stopping you from feeling good and being happy right now? Maybe you believe that you need to lose weight to feel happy or confident. But our minds are like gardens. You know, it's very funny that I have all of these analogies for gardens, weed and the root and gardens, because I cannot even keep like a plastic plant alive. But they come in very well for this purpose. I'm sure some of you are very good gardeners. If you plant seeds of hopelessness, criticism, frustration, you feel terrible. You feel awful. But if you plant hope, acceptance, and compassion, you will flourish and you will feel great. So our minds are powerful. Reevaluate the kind of seeds you're planting in your mental garden. Number three is rely. Rely on someone else, instead of going at it alone. Try leaning on a friend or loved one by sharing your goals, talking about your stumbling blocks, and planning solutions with them, or just being heard, which is so powerful. I have heard it said that a good friend is like a good bra. They're always there to support you. Okay, that was terrible. I would make such a terrible stand-up, but I love it. You get the idea. Support yourself, but also support others. Someone like that on Instagram, thank you. I wish I made that up. I didn't. Okay. I caution you to choose people wisely. Choose who you want in your life wisely, because if someone is negative and not supportive, they might be a bad choice for you. But if someone is good for you, who supports, listens to you, is understanding. Doesn't tell you that it could be worse, or to just drop it, or, you know, just think positive or things like that. If someone says, "Oh, I know that hurts. I'm so sorry. What can I do?" That's a friend. Rely on your friends, because when we rely on other people, we don't use food for fulfillment. When we can fill up on our relationships, we don't use food to symbolically fill a void. Also, revere. Number four, fourth step, revere. Revere your body instead of hating it. Hey, if your mind went to Paul Revere, I've got you covered. To revere something means having deep, adoring respect for it. It is the most profound feeling of gratitude that we can feel. So essentially, you're going to want to have a deep respect for your body. Instead of looking in the mirror and saying, "Oh, this is too much, and that's not enough, and I wish that, and oh my God, ooh." Or, oh, stepping on the scale and going, "Oh my God, oh, I hate myself." We've all been there. That doesn't help. Instead of that, imagine looking into the mirror and saying, "I accept you." When you accept yourself, you're not coasting. You're not just like, "Oh, I'm accepting myself." You're actually telling yourself you don't need to change your body to be acceptable. When you feel good about yourself overall, your mind, your spirit, your heart, your body, it is easier to take better care of yourself. Number five is re-engage. Ever wonder when eating became so complicated? We have so many choices now. Low fat, high fat, low carb, high carb, juice cleanses, keto, paleo, vegetarian, vegan, no sugar, gluten-free, organic, non-GMO. Oh, the list goes on and on. Whole 30. I mean, Weight Watchers. So how did our ancestors survive thousands of years without dieting? Simple. They listened to their bodies. We are up against the $60 billion diet industry. That's right, $60 billion with a B. $60 billion diet industry that is very invested in us hating our bodies and wanting to change. And the $60 billion diet industry separates ourselves from our bodies. We are born to be intuitive eaters. We learn not to be, because we go on diets and a diet tells us what we should eat and what we shouldn't eat. And we lose touch with our bodies, our hunger. Our bodies are so divinely smart. They will tell us what we need. So the secret is to throw out all these rules. Eat clean, don't eat carbs, only eat this, not that, some form of a diet. Throw out all the rules except one. Listen to your body and honor what it tells you. Re-engaging with your body means listening to your hunger signals, your satisfaction levels, and all the other messages that your body sends you. So learning to eat when you're hungry and stopping when you're full and to enjoy food again is a process that takes time, but you can start that process today. If you think you're triggered by food, for example, guess what? You're not. You're triggered by a situation. Food is not the problem. Food is the solution to the problem. So ask yourself, if you want to eat something, if you want to binge on something, is it physical hunger? Is it emotional hunger? Physical hunger is physical. You feel it in your body. Your stomach growls, or you feel lightheaded, or you can't think, and you just feel it, like you feel it physically, and you know you need to eat something. And also, when you're physically hungry, especially when you're really hungry, you're not that picky. Like, if you don't like oranges, but you're starving and there's an orange, you're more likely to eat it. Emotional hunger, on the other hand, is more located in your mind than your body. So it's when something sounds good or looks good. And most importantly, you're going to change the way you feel when you eat it. When you're eating for comfort, for distraction, unconsciously turn emotional pain to physical pain. These are all reasons that you're emotionally eating. And so if you are finding yourself eating for those reasons, ooh, I want that because I'm going to feel better once I have it. Or if I eat that, I'm not going to think about these other things that are bothering me. Or if I eat that, I'm going to obsess about that and I'm not going to think about this. Focus on that. If you don't know what's bothering you, use my food mood formula. That will completely help you. If you don't have it, go to my website, Dr. Nina Inc., drninainc.com, and download your free food mood formula. That will help you. Then express your feelings. Say what it is that's bothering you. And then comfort yourself with words. Reassure yourself. Validate, acknowledge, reassure you. Again, intuitive eating is something that is difficult to do if you're simultaneously struggling with emotional eating of some kind, whether it's binging or whether you're struggling with bulimia or any kind of unhealthy, unhappy relationship with food. It is hard to do that. Josh, I'll be right with you. Let me finish my thought. Give me a second. But you can do both. You can practice identifying physical hunger, identifying what you're hungry for emotionally, what's bothering you. And the more that you can do that, more think about what it is that you're physically hungry for, the more you'll get answers. Hey, Josh.
Hi, Dr. Nina.
Hi, Josh. Happy almost 2022.
Yeah, thank you so much. I just wanted to say that, I'm doing great, and I just wanted to, basically say thank you. And, I've sort of really gotten a lot of benefit from you, and it's been great. And I really don't have much to complain about other than the fact that, I'd like to do sort of more introspection with food, but also just, not necessarily having anything to do with food. I know your show is about food, but
no, it's not. It's not about food. Weed root. People see a weed and think that's the problem, right? But it's not. It's the root that grows the weed. If we just pluck the weed, it's going to grow back. The weed is whatever the problem is with food. So the show is not about food. The show is about finding the roots that create the relationship with food that is problematic.
Yeah. Okay. That makes sense. So, and at some point in our childhood, we conflated food with feelings. Is that basically right?
Sometimes I think what we do is we as infants, we connect being fed with relationship and love, because our very first experience of being fed is being held in someone's arms, usually, and cradled and feeling safe and blissful and being fed by another person. And that's a safe, beautiful, blissful experience when you're a newborn and then a baby and you're being nourished by this person, whether it's a breast or a bottle, you're being nourished by this person. So in our unconscious minds, we don't think of it consciously as this. We don't think, food equals relationship, but our unconscious makes that connection. And it shows up in the vernacular we have in our culture. We talk about being hungry for love, starving for attention, things like that. Comfort food. comfort food is really the wish to be comforted by a person. So that's the connection. And then we celebrate with food, or we, you know, oh, or we're bribed with food. Hey, if you finish everything on your plate, you get dessert, or let's go celebrate with ice cream. So we learn to associate certain foods with certain ways of self-soothing.
Yeah. And I would just say that we're still that infant. I mean, we're not that infant, obviously, but I feel some of our emotional lives might still be very infantile.
Well, I think it's a mistake to call emotions infantile. They're just human. When we're babies and we feel, you know, a certain way, we like little toddlers, when they're angry, they'll scream and cry and have a fit. But that's not being infantile. The feeling is not infantile. The feeling is just anger or frustration. The expression of it is a toddler tantrum, but it's not an infantile feeling. It's just the expression of it can be young. So feelings are feelings regardless of our age. They're not childish. They're not infantile. How we respond to those feelings or express those feelings may be more childish or from childhood than not.
I see. So that makes sense. So if I was upset about something, that could be from very early on, but it also could be very much in the present. And yet, you know, it was something you said to me before, which was, does this remind you of anything? You know, is the pain or the suffering that you're undergoing currently remind you of an early experience? And I feel like that's a very good way to go about doing it.
Yeah, it can be an early experience, absolutely. And that usually is a question you want to ask yourself when you're having a reaction that seems more extreme than the situation would warrant. And that means you're re-experiencing something. And often people will tell me that they are so emotional. They're super emotional. They're extra emotional people. And really what's happened is they just never healed original emotional wounds, which means that when something in their lives in the present comes along and duplicates it or pokes into that wound, they have a big reaction to it. And that's when you want to say, well, where does this come from? How is this familiar?
Yeah. So that's great. You know, I just wanted to check in and say hi. And I would just want to say that, you know, it doesn't mean that we can't change. You know, we would think, well, this is how I am. This is how I'm always going to be, because this is how I was as a little baby. But that's not true, is it?
Oh, it's certainly not true. As long as you've got a pulse, you can change if you're trying to change. People who want to change will change. I like to actually say evolve. You know, that when we learn how to relate to ourselves, to food, to other people, to the world, we learn this way of being in the world. And we can unlearn that and learn a different way. That's what now is called brain plasticity, which is a fancy term for we can learn new stuff. Absolutely. And it is a process. We have to sort of deconstruct what we've learned and then construct a new way.
Yeah. And I would say in psychoanalysis, we use words. We use language to make that change, right? We try to put into words what maybe hasn't been put into words before.
Well, that is true of all types of therapy, but yes, absolutely. And I think what makes psychoanalysis different is that you also use your relationship and things from the past can get re-experienced in the present. So, you know, if you have a judgmental mother and you come to see me and you start seeing me as judgmental, that's transferring the past into the present. And then we can process and heal those original wounds through the relationship. I mean, it's far more complicated than that. But yes, we have to learn to relate differently to ourselves. We need to change our expectations of other people and find a safer, emotionally safer, more hopeful world.
Yeah, that sounds amazing. I feel like, you know, I like what you said there about, you know, seeing the early relationships as guiding the current relationship with you, with me, with the therapist, with the psychoanalyst, or with a talk show host, or whatever it happens to be. But I feel like there's no relationship that we really can remove that's not going to be, you know, something that reminds us of an early relationship. We probably are not being honest with ourselves if we think, no, this relationship is completely not subject to my earlier relationships.
Absolutely right, Josh. Yes. We repeat the past hoping for a different outcome, and we repeat it in two different ways. So let's say you have a parent who is unsatisfied. Nothing you ever do is good enough, right? I think you can relate a little bit to that, Josh. Then but I'm not talking about you, because I don't know that much about your situation, but I'm just talking about a person who has a parent, nothing is ever good enough. You know, they get, you know, 5 A's and an A minus. What's with the A minus? That kind of a thing. Oh yes, clean the kitchen, but you left a spot there. You know, that kind of a person. And it's so hard to be with someone who's never satisfied, who's always finding fault. So how do we resolve this? Well, consciously, you would think you'd find someone who's the opposite, except we don't work that way. We're complicated human beings. So we find someone else who's unsatisfied, someone else who finds fault with us, hoping that that person is going to be a person that we can turn into a person who is satisfied with us, who sees everything, who doesn't pick us apart. And we do that in two ways. We either find that person and become strangely drawn to people who, you know, are familiar, or we find people who are not like that, but we begin to perceive them as if they are. And
yeah,
we do because we hope that we're going to have a different outcome that will heal the original experience. But of course, it just repeats.
Yeah. I feel like your example of the critical parent, that could make us very afraid that someone's going to be critical to us, when we actually might be the critical person ourselves, because sometimes we identify with a parent, and if a parent was critical, then we're going to be unconsciously critical, and then we're going to project it on to the next person we see that this person's just like my dad or whatever, and he's going to be just as critical to me as my dad was to me, when in fact you've inherited some of that critical thinking from the parent, and you identify, we can't help identifying with our parent.
Well, what I find often is that we treat ourselves the way we were treated. People who struggle with a binge eating disorder or you know, some kind of unhealthy, unhappy relationship to food in this way, I find they treat themselves as they were treated, but they treat other people as they would like to be treated. And by the way, how does this all relate to eating? If you are not getting emotional satisfaction from another person, it leaves you empty, it leaves you lonely, it leaves you hungry for being loved and unconditionally loved and understood and appreciated, and you're not getting that from people, we get it from food, which represents people. So in terms of identifying with the judgmental person, often we become judgmental of ourselves, but we're super non-judgmental of other people. Other people become very judgmental of others, but not of themselves. So Again, that's
And I think the way that, because that seems to be very individualistic, the way you're talking, but the way it seems to play out in a relationship is if I'm now very critical and I'm projecting that, I'm going to be afraid, this thing called like fear of abandonment. And food can take a place of a fear of abandonment. In other words, I'm in a relationship with this person. I'm unconscious that this is actually replaying from the past, and I will use food to calm my fear that this person will leave me in the dust. I might be the one who's very critical myself.
Well, also food won't abandon you. People can be unpredictable, unreliable, and unavailable. Food is predictable, reliable, and available. So food can't abandon us. If you have a fear of abandonment, food will never abandon you. And so it is easier to have kind of a relationship with food than it is to people who can be unpredictable and abandoning and rejecting. And so that's why it's so important to look at the symbolism of why you're turning to food, why you're focused on that, rather than just willpower, control, something like that. It doesn't get to the true root issue.
Right. And the idea would be, well, what did it feel like if you were not comforted when you want it to be? Because if you're, like you were saying, food is comfort food to many people. And what was it that I needed comfort when I didn't get it? And what did it feel not to get the comfort that I would have liked to have? Not so much what I'm doing in the moment, eating this cake or this, whatever it is, but what did it feel like not to be comforted when I wanted to be comforted? As opposed, focusing on the feeling.
Well, the feeling and what kind of comfort did you need, and to give that to yourself. Often we're harsh and critical and cruel and mean and terrible to ourselves. And then guess what? We go to food to escape our own mean voice. But if you think, to use your example, what were you feeling, but what did you need? What did you want in that moment that you didn't get? What does comfort sound like, and how can you give it to yourself instead of
attacking? And I think it's very, And you're talking about sometimes maybe it could even be desire. I mean, children are funny in a way. They desire the parent. They don't know what they desire without having any idea. Sometimes they desire their own feces without even knowing what it is. You know what I mean? And I feel like children are very desiring. When they're that young, it's pretty much all desire. And that's right. I feel like if a parent wasn't giving us what we wanted, it would be interesting to sort of parse out what it is that we were desiring. And sometimes those desires are rather sort of uncomfortable and sort of almost shameful in a way.
Well, hunger is a form of desire. And often we get very conflicted about desire, different kinds of desire, because it is it can feel shameful or humiliating to want something you can't have. It is humiliating to want someone's love and they won't give it to you. And it is, can't give it to you in the way that you need it, which is not to say that they're a bad person, but that there often there's mismatch in a family. You know, you have like a child who's warm and touchy and huggy and wants hugs and all of that. And if you have a parent who's like, not so warm and fuzzy, will push that kid away just because, they've got an ambivalence about closeness because they've turned on their desire for closeness or for whatever reason, then the child who has that wish for closeness feels humiliated and isn't going to turn to that person. But it's going to turn to food which represents that person.
Yeah. You know, I feel like, you know, we've gotten away from food, but we really haven't gotten away from food. We're knee deep in the relationship with food because, and that's another thing, to separate food from our emotions is also sort of naive.
Okay. Well, I'm not sure that I would put it that way and say that it's naive. I think that often when, especially as someone who specializes in binge eating disorder or eating disorders in my practice, it's seen as the problem. It is not the problem. It is a solution to the problem. So I talk about food as I'm talking about it on the show, only in terms of what does it tell us about your internal world? What is, so to be a detective of the mind, which I like to say, I'm a detective of the mind. I'm going to solve the mystery. We're going to solve the mystery of why you're doing whatever it is that you're doing that you don't want to do with food. And looking at it that way, like what's going on? What's the mystery here? What's the symbolism? Why did you choose to eat that at that particular time? In my group, one of my groups last week, someone was saying how all of a sudden, she just wanted popcorn while she was watching TV. Just all of a sudden. And it was about popcorn. And I said, well, what were you watching? And much like you're probably familiar with my chunky monkey person who all of a sudden ice cream was calling her name, similar to that, she was watching something on TV that was upsetting her and making her a little angry, and getting popcorn did two things. One, it got her away from the show for a second and gave her a little relief. And two, she went to popcorn, which is in the food mood formula, as you know, is correlated with expressing some form of anger, frustration, irritation, annoyance, whatever. And so popcorn was a clue that something was triggering her. Popcorn was not the problem. It was the solution to the problem. So when I talk about food on this show and with my clients and patients and in my books, I am talking about it as a symbol and a clue to help you figure out what's going on inside. It's not what you're eating, it's why. And when you can crack that code, then you can know what it is you're really fighting.
Yeah, that makes so much sense. I really thank you for going back over that again, because that's right. I think it's like dreams. You know, we dream things at night, and when we wake up, we're like, what in the world was this? And there's symbols in those dreams. And I feel like what you're saying is food is also sort of symbolic to us, like dreams are.
Well, as a psychoanalyst, dreams are one of the way that Freud called it the royal road to the unconscious. It's one of the roads to the unconscious. It's one of the ways that we discern what's going on with someone unconsciously. Same with, that's how I'm using food. It's another road to the unconscious. What is it that's going on that's out of awareness, but not out of operation? You go to food so you don't think or feel certain things you don't want to think or feel. It's a way of coping, but it's a frenemy. It helps you distract from something you don't want to think or feel, but it also hurts you in that it destroys your sense of self. It's bad for your body. It makes you hate yourself. I don't need to explain why it's an enemy. So it's being curious, not critical, and really looking at, well, what's going on here and why?
Yeah. And I think, we're like artists with our choices of food, like your patient or your client was using popcorn. I mean, that's very like creative. It's extremely creative, you know, and I think that's how it probably is. And you could probably agree or disagree, but just like the dream, we're incredibly creative in our dreams. We're incredibly creative in our food choices and when and why and how much. And the idea would be to go from that to, you know, this idea of play and real creativity where the unconscious has been made conscious and you're able to just relate and be with another person and be with yourself.
Well said, Josh. Thank you so much. And thank you so much also for being my probably last caller on the last show of 2021. I'm so glad you began calling the show this year. And I've heard from a lot of people who DM me or email me, and they tell me how much they enjoy our conversations on the show. So I want to thank you and tell you to stay curious, not critical, keep up the good work, and have a happy 2022.
Oh, thank you very much. And I just want to say that the psychoanalyst who said play was, I think, Winnicott. And I was just using his use of the word play. But thank you very much.
Yes, Donald Winnicott, who started as a pediatrician and then became a psychoanalyst. Yes, absolutely. And by the way, one of the things we need to learn more of is to do more play. A lot of kids are getting super overscheduled. They go to school and then they go to piano lesson and they go to kickboxing lesson and then they go to, you know, French lesson and then they do this and this and this, and they're not getting to play. And they need to play for their brains to develop. We need to be more playful and play ourselves as adults. It's so important for so many reasons. So thank you for bringing that up. And of course, you know, Winnicott was one of the greats.
We're using food instead of really playing with each other.
Or yes, I mean, food can also be fun. That's actually a great point. Often we don't have enough fun in our lives, and so food becomes fun. So one of the things that particularly with people who it's about chocolate or things like that, I often find they don't have enough sweetness in their life. And finding more sweetness, more fun is often enough to make a huge difference.
That's a great point, and I appreciate you very much, Dr. Nina.
Thank you, Josh. Happy New Year. Talk to you next year.
Happy New Year.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Aw. Always an interesting conversation with Josh, who clearly is reading a lot of the great old psychoanalytic scholars. Okay, so want to make sure that your New Year's resolutions stick? Past week one or month one. So New Year's resolution excitement wears off quickly. It is easy to forget your New Year's resolution once the champagne is gone and the confetti is cleaned up. Oh, I can't wait to have a confetti champagne type of New Year's Eve celebration. We could all be together. Oh, I long for the day. Okay, so now that you've committed to a new kind of resolution, here are some easy ways to keep them in front of your mind during the coming weeks and months. Set a timer to go off throughout the day on your phone and label it with a positive affirmation, but about your resolution. So for example, I am recommitting to my health. I am recommitting to my health, happiness, self-acceptance, and love. Just a little reminder. Oh yeah, I'm going to be nice to myself. I'm going to be kind to myself. Just set it in a timer. And create a graphic, go on Canva or have a friend make one for you that contains your resolution, and then use it as a screensaver on your phone or on your desktop computer. You can also get it. You can get it printed. You can frame it. You could put it on the wall. Canva is a totally amazing app for this. I'm not advocating Canva. I don't work for Canva. I'm not getting any kind of anything from Canva, but I just personally find it so easy to use and helpful. So that's just my recommendation. Have a bracelet made with a short phrase or word that embodies your resolution and wear it every day so that you have a beautiful reminder of your resolution when you look down at your arm. go to Etsy. Etsy has all kinds of stores. In fact, you know, I say curious, not critical so much, and use my VARI acronym, validate, acknowledge, and reassure yourself, as a way to comfort yourself, that people are asking me, I want a bracelet with that. Where can I get one? I send them to Etsy, but I'm thinking maybe I should make them and have them available on my site. Write it on a sticky note. Put it on your bathroom mirror. Have it be the first thing you see in the morning. Journal about it. Ask yourself every day, how can I, and then insert your resolution there. How can I recommit to myself? How can I recommit, reevaluate, rely on others, revere, and reengage? And when you plan your day, ask yourself, what's one thing you can do to insert resolution here, like whichever one is the one that you want to do that day, or the one that makes the most sense for you for the year. Those five resolutions, by the way, that you don't have to do them all. You could just do one of them or two of them, or you could do them at different times of the year. And then make sure that you actually do the thing that you can do to make that resolution stick. So like my friend, it could be buying yourself flowers, or telling yourself that you accept yourself every time you look in the mirror. It could be whatever it is to you that feels right, that feels good, that feels empowering. Do that. Do that every day. So I hope that this inspired you to change your New Year's resolution to one that empowers you to be kind to yourself and to feel good about where you are right now, while simultaneously wanting, you know, looking down at the past and going, oh, I feel really proud of myself. I've come all the way up to here. And yes, I want to get there. Here I am, balancing all three of those things. And not telling yourself that you're only going to be okay when you get up the ladder, when you get there. No, when then. When I get here, then I'll be happy. No, be happy now. So you are going to be able to take action to be healthier and happier, to lose that negative self-talk, and you will have a better year. Because when you are recommitting to yourself, you're not tearing yourself down. You're not disparaging yourself. You're not being critical. You're not being judgmental. You're lifting yourself up. And guess what? When you lift yourself up, you feel better. And when you feel better, you don't need food to feel better. See how that works? So, which of these resolutions are you going to implement first? And how do you plan to keep it in front of you throughout the year? I would love to know. So, drop me, if you're on Instagram, drop me a comment or send me an email or find me on some social media and send me a DM. I would love to know what you're doing, and I would love to celebrate that choice with you. So I want to thank everyone who has been listening with me, whether you're a longtime listener now viewer, or you've only just discovered the show. I just want to welcome you and remind you that when you have a kind and loving relationship with yourself, everything changes with food, with other people, with the world. I want to end by just telling you a little bit about my view of therapy in a very quick story that involves the artist Michelangelo. So Michelangelo was supposedly asked, probably after someone saw his statue, the David, which is jaw-dropping. I could just stare at that all day. He was asked, how do you turn these great blocks of stone into statues? And Michelangelo said, I do not turn the stone into statues. I free the statues from the stone. Isn't that beautiful? That to me is exactly what we're doing, what I'm doing in my work, whether you're here on the show, whether you're reading my books, whether you're in my programs, any of that, whether you're a client, it's about chipping away at what is keeping you stuck so that you could be your most authentic, true self. It is not about changing yourself into something else. It is about becoming and accepting and cherishing who you really are. And that is my wish for you for 2022. Have a beautiful rest of the year. I will see you next year. Stay curious, not critical. Bye for now.
You're listening to The Dr. Nina Show with Dr. Nina Savelle-Rocklin, only on LA Talk Radio.